Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the federal government is considering turning a long-shuttered Orange County warehouse into a new immigrant processing center. The proposal would repurpose a former Pet Boys facility in the village of Chester, part of a nationwide plan to house up to 80,000 immigrants in warehouse-style sites, and would mark the county's second ICE facility. We'll get the details. Plus, federal funding has been frozen to five states, including New York. The freeze has the potential to be extremely disruptive to services provided by the Department of Child Services and child care providers around Sullivan County. We'll learn more about the impact from Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government and more from the legislature. Plus, it's the latest episode of Curtain Call, our theater podcast. We'll get a preview from Tom Candela after this hour's news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Labor Department reported a further slowdown in hiring last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 120 points in early trading.
U.S. employers added just 50,000 jobs in December, capping the weakest year for employment growth since the beginning of the pandemic in 2020. Bars and restaurants added workers during the month, but retail shops cut back. So did factories, construction crews, and business services. For all of last year, employers added 584,000 jobs. That's a drop of more than 70% from the previous year. Analysts say the U.S. no longer needs to add so many jobs because the workforce isn't growing very much. The labor force actually shrank in December, and the unemployment rate dipped to 4.4%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. has seized another tanker ship, this time east of the Caribbean Sea. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem says it is suspected of carrying sanctioned oil from Venezuela. The seizure comes as President Trump says he'll meet oil executives today at the White House, and he says oil companies will go back into Venezuela and spend at least $100 billion there. President Trump told the New York Times this week the only thing that constrains him on foreign policy is his morality and mind. A new NPR Ipsos poll finds most Americans want the U.S. to be the moral leader in the world, but far fewer think it is. NPR's Frank Lengfit reports.
Just over 60% think the U.S. should be the world's moral leader, according to the poll, but 45% say it isn't. Sarah Bowling is a Democrat who lives in Little Rock. She says the U.S. attack on Venezuela is a good example.
It's not about anything that has to do with the betterment of the people in Venezuela. It's solely due to taking over the resources in that land, and that is not moral to me in my world.
By contrast, more than 60% of Republicans say the U.S. is the world's moral leader and that it should not hesitate to use its military power. Frank Lengfit, NPR News.
The man accused of killing a top healthcare executive in 2024 is due back in federal court in New York today. Lawyers for Luigi Mangione are asking the judge to bar the use of the death penalty in the event of any conviction, as prosecutors want. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports defense lawyers are citing a conflict of interest at the highest federal level.
Luigi Mangione is charged in the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, who was gunned down on a Manhattan sidewalk in December of 2024. Now, his legal team says Attorney General Pam Bondi should recuse herself because before joining the Trump administration, she worked at a lobbying firm tied to UnitedHealthcare's parent company. Prosecutors call the allegations meritless and misleading.
NPR's Windsor Johnston reporting. You're listening to NPR. Police in Portland, Oregon say federal agents shot and wounded two people yesterday afternoon. Federal officials say the two victims are alleged Venezuelan gang members. Demonstrators filled downtown Portland last night to protest. They're also angry over an ICE agent's killing of Renee Good in Minneapolis on Wednesday. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz has declared today a day of unity in Good's honor. Russia says it struck Ukraine today with one of its most powerful weapons, a next-generation hypersonic missile. Russia claims it is responding to a Ukrainian attack on one of President Vladimir Putin's residences. Both Ukraine and the U.S. say that attack never happened. There's a new analysis of weight loss studies. It shows that people who use medicines to lose weight regain it faster than those who rely only on changes to diet and exercise. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has more.
The analysis reviewed 37 studies with over 9,000 participants and found that people regained weight steadily after quitting weight loss treatments. Those using the new GLP-1 drugs gained back weight faster, on average within 1.5 years, compared to people relying on behavioral changes. Metabolic health gains also reversed. Those who used behavioral change also regained weight, but over a slightly longer period, 1.7 years. The finding, published in the medical journal The BMJ, points to one of the major concerns of the new drugs. Their effects fade quickly after people stop taking them. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at Mott.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Dan Hoost is here from Sullivan County Government, and we'll speak to him in just a few minutes. But first, as the nation grapples with the killing of Renee Nicole Good by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer in Minneapolis, reports indicate that a massive vacant warehouse could soon become an ICE facility in Orange County. According to reporting by the Times Union, the federal government is proposing a new immigrant processing facility at the disused Orange County warehouse. Located in the village of Chester, the 401,000-square-foot warehouse is part of a larger plan to house 80,000 immigrants in warehouses across the country. Formerly a Pep Boys warehouse, the facility would be Orange County's second U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar spoke with Sarah Trafton at the Times Union for more details.
The warehouse in Chester, it's proposed as one of 16 processing facilities throughout the country. And the idea is that rather than the existing system, that this would speed up the process of detaining and deporting immigrants. So once they go through those initial processing centers, then they would be sent to one of 7 larger warehouses that are being proposed. And that's where they'd be detained before being deported.
The proposal specifically focuses on short-term, quote-unquote, processing, right? Can you describe kind of what that would essentially look like?
So these facilities wouldn't be like the long-term detainment facilities. It would just be sort of to process the immigrants and then essentially funnel them to another facility where they'd be held until their eventual deportation.
Yeah, and, you know, in the article, it says that local officials, that they were not consulted before the proposal surfaced. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the local reactions that you've heard so far?
Yeah, so the folks that we talked to really, I think, were very caught off guard by the news. They said that specifically the town supervisor said that no one from like the federal government had contacted him about the plans. So really the only reason why anyone knows about them is because of the Washington Post article and the internal documents that those referenced.
And what about local lawmakers? I know that U.S. Representative Pat Ryan had also weighed in.
Yes. Yeah. He was very vocal about being opposed to this facility. And just the general premise behind it, he in his statement, he referenced a quote from one of the officials involved. And they're basically saying that this plan will be like Amazon Prime, except with people. So the whole idea is to make it more efficient.
Yeah, and the location of the proposal, I think, is especially interesting because Chester, New York, is in Orange County, which already has Orange County Jail, which houses ICE detainees and has for years. And the jail has as well faced lawsuits and reports alleging, you know, systemic medical neglect and other issues with those detained. I am curious just how the existing presence of ICE in the area impacts at all or tells us anything at all about the facility. Do you think there's any sort of connection?
I think they're kind of looking to establish these facilities in places where you can easily then transport immigrants back and forth. So this is the only new location being proposed in New York, but it's, you know, southern New York, closer to, you know, access to the city. And as far as the jail already housing immigrants, again, that this new facility is being proposed as a processing facility, which would be different than the long-term detainment facility.
And something maybe for listeners to keep in mind is that the warehouse proposal in Chester is just one of many processing and ICE warehouses that are being proposed. I am curious just about if you know just a little bit more about what kind of control local municipalities or lawmakers have in kind of delaying or stopping a proposed facility like this.
I think that kind of remains to be seen at this point a little bit, just because this is such a new and developing thing. I know the town supervisor, you know, is very against it and wants to do anything he can to prevent it. But as far as what, you know, what means he has to do that against the federal government, I think remains to be seen.
And I think also, Sarah, just the timing of this news coming out right around the time when earlier this week, the ICE enforcement operation in Minneapolis, that ended with a fatal shooting of 37-year-old Minneapolis woman Renee Nicole Good. She was shot and killed by an ICE agent just yesterday during an immigration operation. Just out of curiosity, I'm curious just how you think that incident might impact public perception of ICE right now.
I think that may definitely play into, you know, people who are wary of having this facility, you know, in their backyard, or just more ICE presence than there already is. I know there was a protest earlier in Albany today, and there's one planned tonight in Kingston. So definitely it's top of mind for people right now.
Yeah.
And the protests are about the shooting, not about the warehouse, just to clarify.
Sarah, I know that you're going to be continuing to follow this story. We've been chatting with Sarah Trafton. She's an investigative reporter with the Times Union, breaking down the proposed ICE processing facility in Chester and how a national immigration strategy is colliding with local communities here in the Hudson Valley. You can find her full reporting online at timesunion.com. Sarah, I know that you're going to continue following this story and bringing us updates as you learn more. Thank you again.
Yes, thank you so much.
And a quick break for us. And when we come back, it's Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we've got Darvina Allen, founder of one of the great culinary schools of the world and a beloved ambassador of Irish cooking. At Ballymaloe, she's trained some of the most lauded chefs and cooks across two generations, and she's got a lifetime of stories. We spend the hour with her coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And joining us now, first time in the new year, Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government, who joins us every Friday Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Mm-hmm. Except for the past two Fridays, I haven't been here. It's been 3 weeks already. I can't believe it's been that long. So.
You got a little break from us.
Oh, please. I enjoy this. So this is a lot of fun. So well, I'm thanks for happy
being,
to be back.
Well, thanks for being here. Let's start off the new year with some new news, really. We were talking about the Chester ICE facility, a federal government impact locally, and there's another federal decision that's impacting us locally. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has frozen access to more than $10 billion in federal child care and family assistance funds for five states: California, Colorado, Illinois, Minnesota, and New York, coincidentally all governed by Democrats. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services cites concerns about widespread fraud or misuse of taxpayer dollars. Now, this just happened this week. We've been getting some reaction, including from Sullivan County Chair Nadia Reich. We got the Ulster County Executive weighing in on this. Can you tell us a little bit more about what this impacts, this freeze impacts for families?
Yeah, our Health and Human Services Commissioner John Little was kind enough to provide me with this really cool cheat sheet on what it is that these programs fund, because I'm sure there are many of our listeners, myself included, that have been fortunate enough not to need these kinds of services, but plenty of people do in Sullivan County and around the nation. The first one's the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or we call it TANF, T-A-N-F. It's a federal block grant that's meant to provide flexible funding to help low-income families achieve economic stability. So there's actually direct monthly cash support through, I think, those EBT cards to help pay for basics like housing, food, utilities, other essential needs. There's childcare subsidies so that parents can actually work instead of having to stay home to take care of their kids. There's employment and workforce supports like job training, education, transportation assistance, and other supports to help people find and keep employment. There is a flexible fund for family services that can be used for wage supplements, counseling, family support services. There's emergency and crisis support. This helps families facing urgent needs due to crises, usually one-time cash supports for unexpected expenses and other programs. Then we also have our social services block grant, which helps people achieve or maintain economic self-support and reduce dependency, prevents or remedies neglect, abuse, or exploitation of children and adults, and prevents unnecessary institutionalization by providing community-based care. So, for example, with our child welfare and family services, it provides funding for preventive services that help kids remain safely with their families and reduce time in foster care. Also protects them if they're in cases involving child welfare. It helps fund our foster care support services. Also for adults with mental or physical impairments who cannot manage on their own, it provides funding for that. Funding for services for victims of domestic violence and other protective interventions. And then finally, our child care block grant that is used to help low-income working families pay for child care. Its eligibility is typically at or below federal poverty guidelines, and they receive financial assistance to choose a provider that fits their needs. So, of course, this provides that another aspect of that child care services. We combine that with the TANF funds and the state funds to basically create what John calls a seamless subsidy system for families receiving assistance. So you don't have to be knocking on a whole bunch of doors. You get it all in one place. And so that is what is at risk of going away should this funding be frozen in the long term.
So there are no more details necessarily that you've received or the state's received or you're getting from the state that you know of?
We anticipate there's litigation that's going to commence if it hasn't already. And so at this point, what we do know from the letters that the federal government sent out, they want data proving that there's not widespread fraud by January 20th. Okay. And if they don't get it by then I guess the freeze, my understanding from reading some of it is the freeze is already in effect, at least it's limited. So maybe the freeze becomes more widespread after the 20th. So we're in a position where we have to wait on the state to tell us what's going to happen here, because they're the ones that have the standing to take it to court or to negotiate with the federal government, give them whatever it is that they're looking for. I don't really know how this is going to play out, but it's another worry that we all have to have, not only in government, but the people we serve.
Governor Kathy Hochul has said that New York is prepared to take the administration to court, saying, quote, "We'll fight this with every fiber of our being because our kids should not be political pawns in a fight that Donald Trump seems to have with blue state governors," end quote. This sounds reminiscent of the SNAP benefits back in the fall, where that put the county and everyone into this state of uncertainty. So you're again in limbo, not really sure how you can move forward.
Yeah, it feels a lot of like a lot of brinksmanship that we come right up to the brink, and sometimes we even teeter right over falling into the abyss, and then we pull back. And it's just not the way we would like to work it at the county. We want to work together on this, as I think the legislature chair Nadia Rice said. Listen, we have a welfare fraud task force. It's aggressive. It's active. I mean, every quarter I'm putting out a press release with photos of people who we are accusing of having scammed the system. We don't want taxpayers' money to be fraudulently used any more than any other taxpayer does. But the idea of just coming in and saying, well, we're going to freeze funds because we suspect there's widespread fraud, rather than trying to go after the actual fraudsters, rooting it all out. Mm-hmm. And that's the concern, is that it's the old cliche, throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Sullivan County Legislative Chair Nadia Rice said in a statement to Radio Catskill, as you mentioned, like we, quote, like we do every day, the federal government should be working to identify fraudsters, not be removing critically needed funding from thousands of innocent children and families. This is clearly a political game of retribution, not a sincere effort to root out fraud and abuse, end quote. And Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger also voiced strong opposition, saying the freeze appeared driven more by politics than evidence. Quote, "The freeze announced by the Trump administration has all the appearance of being politically motivated, since it only targets Democratic-led states. Ironically, most of the New York's counties which administer these funds for their communities are Republican-led and will just be hurt as much by the funding freeze," end quote. So again, starting out the new year with some of these, I guess you mentioned gamesmanship, brinksmanship again from Washington.
And it's disturbing and distressing, and in a way that I think could be handled differently, because we, for years, people recognized, I was a reporter back when people recognized that Sullivan County was seen as a place where you came to get services and there wouldn't be any checks, so fraud abounded. Decades ago, that got changed, and that intent has stayed the same. It's not to allow fraud to permeate the system any more than it already does. So it's very frustrating when you're trying to take that proactive approach and yet you're still told you may lose all your funding for the people who are not engaging in fraud, while we're trying to figure out who has or hasn't done fraud. Right. It doesn't make a lot of sense at a logical, rational level.
The legislature met for the first time yesterday in 2026, took care of some business. Nadia Rice back as chair, as we mentioned. Other housekeeping, we'll talk about the calendar being set, Luis Alvarez, the vice chair. But one of the other things that they dove into was, fiscal responsibility. Let's talk about Legislator Salomon recommending a six-month hiring freeze. Why was that put out?
Yeah, he's concerned, and all the legislators are, that we are going to be facing some pretty serious fiscal challenges as 2026 goes along and 2027's on the horizon. We're sort of talking about that now, because if that federal funding is frozen, we may have to dig deeper into our pockets to help the people that we serve, not to just say, you're out in the cold. But there's also other things as well that would come down the pike potentially. We've been talking about this mandate by the state that we have to expand the courthouse or build a new courthouse court facility. So we're still waiting to hear from them as to what the specifics of what they want are. But I expect we'll find that out later. So there's a deep concern on both aisles of the legislature, Republican and Democrat, that we avoid spending beyond our means because we're going to have less of a cushion going forward if we keep diving into our fund balance or surplus funds. So the six-month hiring freeze was not taken up by the legislature yesterday, but I asked our county manager, my boss, Josh Potosik, yesterday. I said, do you think this will be talked about further? He says, undoubtedly, right, they're going to be discussing it further. And so we will take whatever action that they deem necessary. He already has made it clear to commissioners, you know, be very, very judicious about what you're approaching for new positions. Legislator Kat Scott, you know, Nick is a Republican, Kat is a Democrat. Kat said as well yesterday that they're going to be looking very closely at every non-budgeted expenditure or something that would increase a particular line item in the budget. Mm-hmm. So all of us are, myself included, have taken that to heart and are looking everywhere we can to make sure that if we're going to ask for something, that it is justified in every single way it possibly can be. And I'm not saying that people were throwing things out there willy-nilly, recklessly in the past, but there's an extra level of scrutiny that we know that is going to be put on everything, and we need to make sure that we have a very compelling reason, any of the staff, if we want to add something to it. And I sort of think probably, Legislator Brian McPhillips referenced this in December when they adopted the budget, it's going to be more of a status quo year where we're really not adding things.
Well, and a reminder to folks that your boss, County Manager Josh Potosik, proposed a larger tax increase, about a 9% tax increase.
9.1%,
And then the legislature came back in and reduced that to about 2.9%.
I think it's actually 2% even.
2% even, that's right, sorry. That's quite a gap, which we've discussed. Mm-hmm. Does that lead Legislator Salamon to recommend a six-month hiring freeze just to be proactive? Because nobody was asking for new positions yesterday. This is just looking at this saying, maybe we need to close this gap, which we really didn't do when we adopted this budget.
Yeah, I think Nick is just saying, like Kat has been saying too, that, listen, we just all need to make sure that our belts are tightened and that we're not looking at loosening them. As a year goes by, if you look back at all different legislators, there are positions that come up, programs that come up and say, people are saying, we should do this. This is a good thing for the taxpayers. And I think what the message the legislature is trying to send right now to the public as well as the employees is, that's nice, but not this year.
Does the county already have some open positions that are critical that should need to be filled?
Yes. Josh was indicating to me he thinks legislators will continue to be reasonable and judicious about that. He doesn't anticipate that they're going to say, you know, we have a commissioner. There's not a commissioner position open, but for argument's sake, that we have a commissioner position open, but you're not going to be allowed to fill it. Mm. Obviously, there are certain positions that you have to fill. And we're not looking at cutting anybody at this point, which is good as well. But sort of saying, like Legislator McPhillips said, status quo.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dan Hoost, Communications Director from Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday, except for the end of the year where we give him a break. It's the first time where he's come in for 2026. There's some new hardware and software being switched out next week at the Department of Motor Vehicles. Normally, we wouldn't spend too much time on some computer changeouts, but it's the DMV.
It's a wholesale switch out.
Yeah.
It is a wholesale switch out of the entire computers and the software system the state is mandating. They're paying for this. We're not paying for it at the county level. We just offer the service there through the county clerk's office. But the clerk, Russell Reeves, was at legislature yesterday and said there's already been some ups and downs with the new software that they've been training on. So he's a little concerned about it all, hopes the state will put out a press release shortly explaining more. But if they don't, we're going to be putting something out. And I have a feeling that it might include some plea with people for their patience that this new system, even if we know what we're doing on it, may or may not work exactly as it should. Like I said, it's a wholesale switchover. You know how it goes when you switch out computers where you work or even at your home.
Even when you get a new phone. Yeah. How does this thing work?
And it's a system, I believe it's replacing a system that's been around for many years. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be some bumps in that road.
Some disruptions.
And he wanted people to be aware of that. And I think that switchover starts next week. I don't have an exact date yet, but as soon as we know more, I'm going to share that with everybody, including JFF.
Just be aware if you're getting that new Real ID or New ID or any other DMV business that they're might be some extra time you'll need to allot.
But we still intend on giving good customer service as much as we're able. So
there's a groundwater study that's set to begin. When is that starting?
Well, it hasn't really started yet. We're finalizing a vendor. I believe we have somebody in mind who we just have to now finish awarding a contract to. I don't have their exact name yet, but we had anticipated that it was going to be about $500,000 cost to do this groundwater study, a study of our aquifer system. But it turns out that the quotes came in for much less than that, and we only had $250,000 to throw at it anyway. So now it turns out that we aren't going to have to look for any grants or any outside funding. In fact, I'm told it's well under $250,000 is what probably the final awarded bid will be. And what that will allow us to do is a critical second part of an overall water study that we've been doing. The first one that our Division of Planning launched and has now finished was inventorying our municipal water and wastewater infrastructure. What do we have? What's capacity? Where does it serve? That kind of thing. And now the second part of it is, what do we have in terms of natural water resources? Those underground aquifers that many of us get our drinking water and washing water and all our home water needs from. So knowing what's underneath us across our 1,000 square miles, what invaluable information that's going to be for decades to come.
Which you didn't know. It hasn't been done before.
No. Right. It's been done partially in different places. We have some ideas. And I think the DEC and the United States Geological Survey and other have different estimates based upon test drilling they've done. But this is going to be a very methodological?
methodical.
There we go. Thank you. what would I do with that, Tim? methodical effort to understand our water resources so that when we are looking at development in the county, which the county wants especially commercial development, but also residential development, what areas of the county can sustain that? What areas do we have to be more careful about? And that's going to be turned into publicly available data in the forms of maps and figures that anyone will be able to access. Now, I think we're talking a year or two out before that data is available for everybody, but it's exciting that we're doing it. It's not a question now. We have the money, we have a vendor, and we're going to start it this year with, I think there's going to be test drilling and bores and things happening. If anything, by the way, if people are concerned about anything happening on private property, that would have to be agreed to by them. So it's not like you're going to find people trudging through your forest and drilling into your land. That's not how this will work.
Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll look at how Sullivan County residents registered to vote in 2025, some trends by age and gender and more with Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
On This Old House Radio Hour, an easy-to-follow year-round home checklist that'll keep repairs small and stress low.
Home maintenance doesn't really have to be overwhelming. Draining your water heater may sound more intimidating than it is, but really, that can be completed in 3 to 4 steps.
Plus, cheap old houses are back with 2 historic southern homes in need of some thoughtful renovations. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple. Free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're with Dan Hoost, Communications Director of Sullivan County Government. There's some interesting data from the Board of Elections. Voter registration trends in 2025 shows how Sullivan County registered to vote. What's this new report showing us in terms of age, gender, other demographics?
Well, first, a shout out to the Board of Elections intern, and I hopefully won't butcher his name here, Isaias Taylor Ukoidamabia. He recently joined Board of Elections as an intern and promoted this idea of this report to the Board of Elections commissioners, Deanna Senek and Pam Murren, who said, yeah, go for it. And because I don't know the last time we've seen a report like this. Yeah. It's not a mandated service right. of the Board of Elections, but it's a wonderful thing that they did. For those who are going to be looking it up, there's some graphs and other information. It's part of the agenda packet that legislators saw yesterday for the Government Services Committee. And it really painted an interesting picture of Sullivan County and our voting populace. A little surprising to me, but among the two main parties, the Democratic Party had the edge over the Republican Party. I thought that had flipped a few years ago, but I guess not. The Democrats have 34% of the county's registered voters, while the Republicans have 33%. So I would sort of call that a dead heat. Yeah. 7% of registered voters are in what are called minor parties, you know, something like the, I think the Working Families, Green parties, that kind of thing. But an astounding 26% of registered voters are not registered in any political party. Mm-hmm. They're registered to vote, but they're not with any particular party. Of course, as Isaias noted, that varies greatly depending on whatever demographic is being analyzed. For example, when broken down by gender, it's found that 29% of men were registered Democrats, 36% of men in Sullivan County were registered Republicans. So much more Republican than Democrat when you're talking about men. 8% in another party and 27% not registered in any political party. When you switch over to women, the breakdowns are 39% Democrat, 29% Republican, similar 7% not registered with, or registered with a minor party, and 26% not registered with anyone. And then we also track for those whose genders are either intersex, unknown, or unspecified, their breakdown, interestingly enough, 26% Democrat, 40% Republican, 6% minor party, and 27% no party at all. And it goes from there. There's, we break it down by age, other things. Your reporter, Kimberly Izar, yes. did a wonderful piece about that that really goes into more depth, and I won't duplicate with her, but I will add a few things. We looked at the general election statistics, too, this year, and total number of Election Day voters was 17,117. Of that, 2,463 people voted early, 844 did absentee voting, and 1,853 did the rather newer thing of the early mail voting, leaving just under 12,000 people who actually came in person on Election Day to vote. So that's still the most popular.
And I know it's really early in the year talking about elections, but this is interesting data, and you can see more of Kim's reporting at our website, wjffradio.org. But also a note that this year's local elections will be just as important as they always are, but because of the even odd year change in the mm-hmm. calendar, a lot of the people that were up or offices and positions that were up in November this past year will be up again this November.
Yes, they will. There are a number of different town officials who are serving 1 year terms because of the law that the state and Governor Hochul put into play. I think it was passed a few years ago, but it's now finally it's taking effect, where these elections have to happen on even years. And that will affect our legislature elections. Some county elections do not, things like sheriff, though there are certain positions that are not affected by that, but legislators will be affected by that, so that the next legislature, that has already been scheduled. They're serving 4 year terms, so the next election happens next year in 2027, an odd year, but those terms will just be for 3 years, whoever wins those, so that then we can come into the even year balance that we're supposed to be
at. This all sounds confusing. It's even more important to register to vote and show up to vote, because things have changed, and there's much more to remember. So go register to vote, and then we'll have more election coverage, I'm sure, as move forward.
And
of course
keep
we
checking
will.
The Board of Elections webpage, which I help maintain. That's where you're going to get the information. We try to make it as understandable as possible.
I want to note that Kathleen Lara assumed officially her mantle of county treasurer, new county treasurer.
Yes. Congratulations, Kathleen. She is just a wonderful person. We're kindred spirits. She and I are, we call ourselves the unofficial morale officers of the Government Center. She's downstairs, I'm upstairs. So but we are those sicky sweet people that you're like, oh, why are they in a good mood on a Monday morning? And we just are, and
I
we like spreading
Friday
the
mornings.
Joy around.
Every so Friday morning, I say
no, but on Monday mornings, you know, when we come in, we're like, hi, how are you? And everyone's like, it's a Monday morning. It's like, well, great, we got lots of stuff to do this week. Oh, shut up, leave me alone. But she's wonderful. She has been under the former county treasurer, Nancy Buck, for I think it was like 11 years, if I recall correctly. And she really knows her stuff. She's got her own deputy now, a nice young guy named Chris DiBartolo, who's very excited about learning everything he can from her. He has worked in the treasurer's office for a while.
There's a hazard mitigation plan underway. You're urging the public to weigh in. What's this plan do, and how can folks weigh in?
Yeah, this is a plan that we have already in existence, and every few years it has to be updated by state law, but also the fact is that it makes sense to update the hazard mitigation plan because hazards change. I know 20 years ago we had what seemed like one 500-year flood after another. And then in the years since, that sort of hasn't happened. But we've had other issues. We had some major forest fires going on. We also, of course, had the COVID pandemic, which is considered also a hazard that we have to deal with. So what we're asking people to do is to assist our planning division and our consultant in identifying all the hazards that they think exist or could exist in where they live or where they work. And we actually have a survey available. It's something that can be answered pretty quickly and anonymously. You can find it on our planning division website or in our press releases on the website. I'm not going to read the link. You'll be rolling your eyes at me. We also have a separate survey out for people who work for local utilities, transportation companies, businesses, emergency services, and health providers, because, of course, they're going to be very much impacted and involved in responding to these hazards. So you can help us make sure that this hazard mitigation plan is as comprehensive as possible and that we're not missing anything that might be, say, unique to Jeffersonville versus not an issue that would happen in, say, Fallsburg. So it's really crucial that the public help us out with that. We stop collecting that information at the end of this month. So do it now rather than later.
It's sunny, a little warmer outside. You may be fooled into thinking it's spring, but it's not. But it's that type of, have you seen this before on social media? Like the different seasons in the Catskills upstate? Like this is like fake spring.
Yes,
that
is
time of the year when you break all the winter stuff and sometime in too early and you think, oh, wait.
What?
And
then, can I open my windows? Yeah, don't you dare.
No, it's all going to come back. But it's not too early to talk about litter pluck, which is the spring cleaning and year-long almost effort to clean up roadside trails and even shorelines in the county. It is actually a successful program. You've got some numbers showing how successful litter pluck is.
Yeah, this was great. Our planning commissioner, Heather Brown, who oversees our Parks, Recreation, and Beautification office, shared this with legislators yesterday. Our litter pluck program runs from April to October. It's not just a spring cleaning thing. Yep. And so we take in litter for free from people, whole bags of it, no charge, from roadsides, and more recently, actually, bodies of water we started accepting it from. So we collected 429 bags of garbage in 2025, 71 tires, 2 tons of construction and demolition debris, and a quarter of a ton of municipal solid waste, which we would call sort of household waste. A lot of the stuff you're finding along the roadsides is of lightweight, so that shouldn't be like, oh, a quarter of a ton, that's not much. No, that's a lot. It's just, you know, we're talking about cans and paper wrappers and things that you see along the edge of your road. We want to encourage constantly people to pick that up. Yeah. No matter where you are, as long as you can do it safely, pick that stuff up, put it in a bag, bring it to our transfer stations. All you got to do is tell us, I picked this up along the road or in a body of water. We're not going to question you or search through it and be like, you got household garbage in here. It's the honor system. Yeah. And we'll take it off your hands for free.
And also, another thing that you'll let folks recycle with you are Christmas trees.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You have a Christmas tree that you're taking down, and if you haven't already, my mother would say it should have been down weeks ago, but she asked me the other day, did you take down your Christmas tree yet? I was like, and she loves Christmas, but it's like, when it's done, it's done.
She's done.
Love you, Mom, if you're listening.
Anyway,
But if you have, and I'm talking only about natural Christmas right. trees, not an artificial tree that you want to get rid of. We can't turn that into mulch, but we can turn a natural tree into it.
Okay. So, Dan Hoos from Sullivan County Government, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We'll see you next Friday.
Looking forward to it.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, it's the latest episode of Curtain Call from Tom Candela. He's here next with the preview. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Kimberly Izar, host of Farming Country. This week, migrating bald eagles return to the Upper Delaware River. We spend a morning at the Zane Grey Museum in Lackawaxen, Pennsylvania, learning what makes eagles so special.
I just find them so majestic, and to watch them glide, there's seems like nothing can stop them, so they're powerful.
That's this week on Farming Country, Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and every Friday, it's a new episode of Curtain Call, our theater podcast. Drops online at wjffradio.org. And here to tell us about this episode this week is Mr. Tom Candela, host and producer. Hello.
Hello, and Happy New Year.
Oh, yeah, it's our first time Happy New Year-ing on the air.
Yes, and this is this episode is the first episode of 2026.
Yeah, so who are you talking to today on today's episode?
Yeah, I had two very creative artists, performer Drita Kabashi and director Megan Finn, who has actually been on the show before in an episode probably back in April or May. And we're talking about a new one-woman show. I shouldn't say no. It's coming to our neighborhood in New York City this weekend, A Trojan Woman. It is not really new. It's actually like 2,000 years old because it was first written by Euripides back in the day, if you will. And it was considered to be one of the first anti-war plays of its time. And they're bringing it to New York City this very weekend. And it's a very exciting thing to know about and to learn about, the ancient Greek tragedy. And as I said, it was considered to be an anti-war play. And they're bringing it to New York City this very weekend.
2,000 years later, finally, we get a chance to hear about it. Here's a preview of it on this week's episode of Curtain Call with Tom Candela.
Thank you, Tim. On today's show, we're going to be face-to-face with a story that's more than 2,000 years old, really. I'm talking about a show called A Trojan Woman. It's a very powerful one-woman theatrical experience adapted from Euripides, The Trojan Woman, widely considered the very first anti-war play in Western theater. And joining me on the show are two of the artists who are at the very heart of this production. Drita Kabashi is the remarkable performer who carries this entire piece on her shoulders, stepping into the voices of 10 different characters, each telling a story of loss, survival, and endurance. And returning to Curtain Call is director Megan Finn. She is the artistic director of The Tank, whose vision has helped shape this haunting and deeply human adaptation by playwright Sarah Farrington. Megan, Drita, I want to welcome both of you to Curtain Call.
Thank you so much for having us. Welcome. Yes, thrilled to be here.
Well, I'm going to put the first question to you, Megan. What was the first thing that compelled you to bring A Trojan Woman into the spotlight? And what did you immediately sense it could say to today's audiences?
Sure. Well, the play was initially commissioned by artistic director Aris Asproulis for the Inter-Balkan Festival of Ancient Greek Drama. He had seen Drita's performance in a play that we were doing in Athens, Greece, and approached me about putting together a commission that would feature her. I immediately thought of Sarah Farrington because of her wealth of knowledge of Greek plays in particular to approach the adaptation. And so the impetus for it was really Drita's ability as a storyteller, but also this desire to make a piece that is powerful and relevant and can continue to have this difficult story about conflict. Sarah Farrington actually thought, oh, wow, what a good challenge to try to make, to take this play and adapt it into a taught one-person interpretation. And so it was also out of the challenge of it, how to make it feel relevant to today. And I think she did that very well.
And Drita, were you actually involved in any of the writing with Sarah?
I would not say that I was in the writing room in any capacity, but we have been, as Megan was saying, working on this piece since 2023. So, you know, it continues to, I think, become more and more polished, not just through the performance, but even actually through the writing. It's always evolving and it's always unfolding.
What has been the reception overall from some of the audiences as you perform it?
Well, unfortunately, this is a pretty universal story.
Yes.
And so I think overall people can relate to it, once again, unfortunately, especially places that have had recent conflicts and struggles. I know in Ireland it was like really well received because I think people really connected to the material. But it's also a huge gift for me as an actor to be able to perform this and for all of us to sort of collectively grieve for what is happening, what has happened in the world historically, and what is happening currently.
And I should say that Drita performs this also in rep with Maddie Robinson, Madeline Rose Robinson, who is another actor who's very close with Drita, and they performed together previously. We've done this show in Pennsylvania. So it's had this long trajectory of performance, and I think we, every time we work on it, we find new things, hear things differently, understand things differently. And so that's been a joy amidst the pain of the subject matter. And also just the virtuosity, it has been called by numerous critics a tour de force, and that is the perfect expression for it, because watching Drita on this journey it's like one of those performances that people remark again and again.
Yeah. So Drita, it is also framed that the character remains nameless. Was that specifically to be an everyday woman?
Yeah, actually, I think you're right on the nose there. I think she's this mother who, in a flash of modern warfare, kind of in order to contend with her grief and the sort of how massive the loss is, not just her personal loss, but just the sort of meaninglessness of violence and war. She's like possessed by these historical characters. So in many ways, she's a vessel for this, unfortunately, sort of perpetual grief in humanity. And so I think it's so interesting that you say she remains nameless. You're completely right. For me, she's so specific,
right?
that I forgot that actually, in fact, the gods, I think, only refer to her as a civilian, but I don't think her name is ever said in the play. So yes, I think that's the idea. I think she's supposed to be this vessel, or this every woman, or this every person, this conduit for this sadness.
But there are also other characters in the show. In fact, you embody 10 distinct characters. So how do you build a clear physical and vocal transition between each one? How do you do that?
Yes, this was a challenge. I mean, I think actually the voice does most of the heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. I think once I found how these characters sound, then that made the most sense. So I think the vocal aspect is does a lot of the heavy lifting. I think where vocals fall short, you have a physicality that you kind of lean
yes.
into. And then if the physicality stops short, you have a prop. Every character has a prop. Poseidon has this water bottle he's always sipping on. And like, yeah, and Athena has her spear. And so I think it's this symphony of tools mm-hmm. that come together to tell the story. But you know, I think Megan also sort of was like, it's as easy as turning your head. So the audience is with you. And so all you kind of have to do is turn your head and drop into every character. And I know that this sounds sort of like silly, but or tedious maybe, or superficial. It's not some like big fancy actor answer, but storytelling can really just be that simple. So I think, yeah, I think it's a symphony of all of these things that come together to create distinction between these characters, even when they're happening at such a sort of high pace, you know,
yeah.
movement.
Well, critics, again, I've read some of the reviews, and at least one of them said, describes your performance as a whirlwind. That's a quote. Okay. And they were talking specifically about your emotional and physical intensity. So, Megan, from a director's point of view, in watching her, what did you see as Drita created these characters and continues to create these characters that distinguishes each one of them?
So the thing that I enjoy the most about watching this show continuously and working on it is the extremity of beats where you have the most devastating moment. And then in the next instant, there's like a kind of hilarity, levity that just comes out. And that is the script, but it's also the way that Drita has a kind of playfulness. Playfulness doesn't really sum it up. It's kind of, we always joke that like, even though you'd assume that Drita's inspiration would be like the most decorated RSB actor because she just possesses this command of her voice and the stage. She also loves Bugs Bunny.
I do too. Yeah.
And there are moments where you're like looking at someone that possesses something that is essentially Bugs Bunny. And so watching that, moving between those kind of the gravitas of these Greek gods, right? And then this kind of absurdity of the movement is part of what makes it so compelling. And part of the way that the audience can be with us. This is so intense to watch and think about and live in for an hour that there has to be that theatrical momentum that takes them through the story. And that is how we achieve it and how she achieves it. But I will say, like, this performance, I think, is just other level, and getting to share that with audiences around the world has been just so incredible. And then I think that the simplicity of what we've made with Sarah's work and the process with Drita, and that the whole story comes out of these everyday things. And so that's, I think, one of the things that's so compelling about it. It's like, what do we need to tell a story? What do we actually need to do this story? At any rate, it's part of the magic of the piece.
Yeah, I just to jump in, I had a friend who saw the show and she said, if aliens were to land on Earth and ask us what theater is, I would just show them this play. And I think that's kind of the idea, because it really is like brass tacks. What do you, as Megan is saying, what does it take to tell a story? And you kind of just need an audience and a performer or performers and a stage. And it does lay bare that reality, this project.
Megan, if someone comes not knowing anything about the Greek tragedies, what do you hope that they actually leave understanding about the world we live in now?
I do think that people will be impacted by this play, regardless of their understanding of the Trojan women or Euripides. Mm-hmm. I think that we all have a responsibility to stand up against oppressive forces, and because we could all fall victim to them, I think those people should see themselves in this story. It's about mourning the victims of war, but also understanding how we all participate in the systems that give rise to it, and that we should all continue to try to make the world a better place.
Tell us when we can see this show, where it's playing, the times, and how we can get tickets.
It is taking place January 10th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. and January 11th at 1 p.m. and 5 p.m. at the Tank Theater in Manhattan, 312 West 36th Street between 8th and 9th Avenues. And you can get tickets by visiting the Tank's website at thetanknyc.org.
And it was a pleasure to have both you ladies on the show today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
And a reminder that the latest episode that you just heard a preview of is available at our website, curtaincall@wjffradio.org. That will do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend. And thanks for listening.
Recently on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Paula Poundstone told us her secret for getting through the cold winter months.
Hot chocolate with mushrooms, a party in a cup.
I'm Peter Sagal. Paula returns this week to let us know how the party's going. Plus, we're joined by actor Delroy Lindo on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill. Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeffersonville Bake Shop, open every day of the week for breakfast, lunch, and after-school snacks. Also featuring olive oil, ceramics, and other handmade items by artisan makers in Palestine.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, some occasional rain and drizzle this afternoon with a high of 43, 31 for a low tonight, and for the weekend, rain continuing in the afternoon tomorrow with a high of 38, showers in the evening possible, and for Sunday, maybe some snow showers in the afternoon and a high of 37. On Point is next.